This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Falkowski, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. Our special guest today is author J.M. Beach, who has written two books on education, testing, and accountability that we'll review today. J.M. Beach is the founder and director of 21st Century Literacy, a nonprofit organization focused on literacy education and teacher training. The organization offers a free web textbook and other educational materials, as well as workshops, teacher training seminars, and consulting. I will put a link to this organization in the show notes and on the Facebook page for people who are interested. Dr. Beach has advanced degrees in the field of English, history, philosophy, and education, and is finishing an MBA. He's an entrepreneur, investor, a writer, and an educator, was a lecturer in higher education for over 20 years in the U.S., South Korea, and China. Welcome, Dr. Beach.
Thank you so much, Karen.
So Dr. Beach has two new books. One is titled, Can We Measure What Matters Most? Why Educational Accountability Metrics Lower Student Learning and Demoralize Teachers. And the second one is The Myths of Measurement and Meritocracy, Why Accountability Metrics in Higher Education Are Unfair and Increase Inequality. So links to the books and information about Dr. Beach will be linked in the show notes and on the WGTD webpage, as well as our Facebook page. So if you want to, you can access them there. But let's just start asking a little bit about these books and what Dr. Beach is proposing and what his critiques are. So the accountability movement in the United States is not about improving education in your estimation. So I'd like to just kind of start at the beginning. When you talk about accountability movement, what do you mean? So what do we mean by the accountability and how does it apply in US schools?
That's a good question, because a lot of people use the word accountability without having a clear definition, because it can mean many different things to many different people. I take it all the way back to the 19th century and link it to a movement to kind of organize, rationalize, control schooling for social, political, and economic purposes. And largely, there was a movement in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to rationalize, organize, and control all organizations, government, private sector, and schools, hospitals, everything. And so there was a movement that was kind of focused on businesses, private businesses, corporations, which were really just being developed in the early 20th century. And there was this idea that there needed to be a specially trained manager or group of managers who would organize and control the organization to make sure that it was as productive as possible, and also to make sure that it was efficient as possible so that money wasn't being wasted. And so this model, this top-down authoritarian model, command, control, measure everything and try to squeeze out every dollar's worth, was applied to schools. And a lot of college-educated men were very enthusiastic about trying to make schools productive and efficient. And they talked about teachers and students as if they were raw ingredients, as if we were making canned peas or an automobile. And so the idea was that we could remake schools as these modern bureaucratic organizations where we measured everything and had control over everything and were able to produce the maximum amount of learning with the minimum amount of cost. Now, this idea was obviously ridiculous and impossible, but you know, by and large, most educators, educational administrators at the time bought into it. And certainly a lot of politicians and business leaders, economists were very enthusiastic about trying to transform schools into lean, green, money-making machines.
And I think one of the things that helped them in this vision was the fact that teachers at the time were primarily young women, and there were actually prohibitions on married women continuing to teach, and certainly women who were pregnant or parenting young kids were forbidden from teaching contracts in a lot of cases. And so what you had was this churn of a whole group of young women who would move in and out of the school workplace until they got married or started having children. And this really was continued until after the post-baby boom years, when they just couldn't do that anymore. They couldn't fire people for getting married because they didn't have enough teachers.
Right. Yeah. The model was predicated upon workers who were economically underprivileged, who were vulnerable. You know, the basic idea was that you paid a person the minimum amount as possible, not even the basic amount to keep a person alive, but the minimum amount that anyone on the street would accept. You know, that was the kind of factory model. And in education, as you say, yeah, it was primarily young women who were the teachers and men who were the administrators, and certainly the college professors and college administrators and politicians. And so the idea was that men would manage this kind of vulnerable group of workers who really didn't have very many options. So they would, you know, take whatever they were given in terms of a salary and pay and position, and pretty much do what they were told, because, you know, the model at the time that women didn't have the same social or political rights as men. And so they weren't in a position to question any orders or authority. So they were the perfect kind of test subject to try to create a docile workforce that would follow the commands of administrators in remaking schools.
So describe this transition of school from what used to be kind of a rare opportunity. I don't think people are quite aware most of the time how few people actually attended high school a century ago compared to the way it is now. And, you know, how did this change the purpose and tone of education?
Yeah, I mean, schooling for most of human history was primarily for a select group of usually privileged young men. Largely coming from the upper class. And it wasn't really until early to mid 20th century for most countries on this planet that a majority of students, for the first time in the history of, you know, the human race, that were able to go to school and actually use schooling as an institution to help them lead a better life and kind of open up opportunities. So in the early 20th century, you know, we're talking, you know, 5%, 10% maybe, of students went to high school, graduated, and even less than that, you know, eventually would go into higher education. And so, you know, GI Bill, a lot of veterans came back, and then you had women's rights movement, and then you had civil rights movement, you had kind of a youth movement in the 60s and 70s. And so by the middle to late 20th century, you had everyone, including the disabled, everyone was able to go to school for the first time. And was required to go to school for the first time. And so schools had to dramatically increase. We had to build new schools. And in the early 20th century, we created new kinds of schools, like the middle school and the junior college, community college, that these didn't exist before that. And so we had more schools, more kinds of schools, a lot more students. And of course, this was all very expensive. And so with this transformation of kind of massifying education, schooling, accommodating the majority of, you know, young people, there was this huge bill. And by and large, it was going to be paid by taxpayers. And so that created its own problems. And that, number one, institutions before that time, you know, schooling was largely free for students, that it was paid for by the local community, paid for by rich benefactors, paid for by state or government. And now institutions had to foot a big part of the bill themselves, and tuition was created, and they had to go out and, you know, get private monies and donation to pay their bills. And so over the course of the 20th century, you saw, you know, tuition bills rise, you know, schools and especially institutions of higher education have to cover more of their costs through state and local means. And taxpayers paying more of that money and then grumbling about how much money they were paying, especially older taxpayers who didn't have any kids in the school system anymore. You know, why should I be paying that bill? You know, and so there was this larger conversation starting in the 50s and 60s of how we should think of education and schooling as a private good rather than a public good. You know, if you want to go to school, great, you pay for it. We're not going to pay for it. I'm not going to pay for it. You know, that's your good. It's going to help you. You have to pay for it or find a way to pay for it. And especially this was the case for higher education. So there was a kind of a transformation of expectations that school wasn't free. It was very costly. And that reinforced the notion that we had to control those costs in some way. And we had to demand some clear sense of outputs. Are we actually getting something for our money? Or is it just being wasted by these feckless teachers and administrators and schools just spending on who knows what, you know? And so that kind of created and reinforced that conversation of accountability. We had to keep schools and all that money accountable to someone, supposedly to taxpayers or government, to the public.
So so then what you're talking about is this whole idea of what gets measured gets managed. So we want to measure output. We want to make sure that the money we're putting in is being transformed into learning. And so we're going to measure it. Is there something wrong with this idea? I mean, don't we want to know if our students are learning and if teachers are effective?
The basic idea is sound. It's a good idea, and it's predicated on science, on evidence, on the idea that we should gather data and evidence from the real world to try to figure out what's really going on and use that data and evidence to then gauge the effectiveness of you know, our individual actions, organizational actions, you know, government, that we can use this data to live better, to make better organizations, better activities that help us reach our goals better at, you know, less cost. It's a great idea. But how do we actually do it? Now, how you go about measuring and then, you know, making judgments based on those measurements in terms of what should we do now, it's a tricky situation. And it varies depending on, you know, what the phenomenon is that you're studying. You know, a factory owner trying to measure how many canned peas are being produced at what cost is very different than an automobile, which is very different than a service, you know, a customer service like a restaurant, which is very different than a different kind of service of delivering education and knowledge to students, you know, to help them to do and then, you know, enter your XYZ, what are schools for, you know, and that's another part of the equation. Then a business is, it often goes without saying, a business is designed to make money. You know, most people find that very unproblematic, although now in the 21st century, we have realized that, yeah, but there's also some social aspects, environmental aspects, you know, there's more than just making money that's important. But for every organization and institution, you know, what's the purpose? Answering that question is not always simple and easy. So what is the purpose of a school? That opens up a big can of political worms. And never has there any been a clear answer about what is the purpose of a school. And still to this day, we have violent, not just conflict, but violent conflicts over trying to define the purpose of school and education and who gets a say and who determines that. So in order to measure something and use a system of measurements in order to understand and then improve performance, you first have to have some understanding of measurements for what, you know, what does the organization do and why does it do it? And so schools have always had, you know, a lot of unanswered questions about what they do, how they do it. And then when it comes to transforming young people, transforming human beings, educating them, that's not a process that can largely be seen and even understood. And so how do we actually measure that? That's a very difficult, complex question. And the measurements that were created over the course of the 20th century, they were always extremely imperfect and often invalid. And they didn't really measure what they were supposed to be measuring. And so they were very imperfect pieces of data in terms of understanding what's going on in a student's head. How is the school helping this person to do what, to know what, and then trying to, you know, use that as a way to determine cost effectiveness or, you know, institutional effectiveness. So the measurements were often designed more for expediency. They were cheap or easy. And so we ran with those measurements, but they didn't necessarily measure what we thought they were measuring, or they didn't measure it at all, but it was just cheap and easy to make this measurement. So we ran with it.
So let's just talk about one of these measurements that's been used. Let's talk about the IQ test. Talk to us a little bit about what that is and how it was developed and why it's not a valid tool in your opinion.
Yeah, so the IQ test, which I think a lot of people now understand its limitations and flaws. There was a lot of controversy in the 90s that kind of finally put that test to bed. But in the early 20th century, this test was devised out of this false theoretical understanding of the human mind, that there was some property in the brain, which scientists labeled G, which was this general intelligence, and that somehow we could measure this thing in the brain. It doesn't exist. It never existed. There was no proof. It was just an idea that someone had. And so, number one, you know, this test, this SAT test, was built on a fiction. You know, it was built on a myth. And so when you create a measurement, and there is no empirical evidence that what it is you're measuring actually exists, you know, we could create measurements to measure pink dragons. You know, if we don't actually have some real pink dragons to show and prove to people, you know, how valid is this measurement? What are we actually doing? So SAT is one of those examples where we were trying to measure something that doesn't really exist. Mm-hmm. Now, with that said, though, scientists were able to, as they kind of worked with this measurement, they realized how much, you know, it didn't really work and that it was based upon this false understanding of the brain. And as we better understood the brain and the functioning of, you know, what we call intelligence, you know, there is something in terms of how our brain works in various parts that does produce this concept that we can call intelligence. And we have validated through, you know, decades worth of research that there is intelligence that humans have that can be roughly measured. And it has some correlation to certain activities like going to school. But it doesn't actually matter a whole lot in terms of, you know, some widespread goals, like, for example, getting a job. You know, or, you know, social intelligence or emotional intelligence. There are other traits about us as human beings that enable us to be very successful at reaching our goals. And so intelligence, which is loosely correlated to, you know, thinking and the ability to make judgments and decisions and, you know, remembering knowledge and be able to use that to do an activity, it has some correlation to how well a student can do in school, and it is loosely correlated to, you know, the individual and genetic, you know, programming of that person and their parents. But it doesn't necessarily determine what a student can do now or in the future, and it's not a measurement that stays stable. You know, as individuals grow from children to adults, that measure changes, and as you know. Individuals engage in activities, that measurement changes. So it's not a stable measurement. So it's not a stable aspect of any human being's, you know, biology by any means. So what good does it actually do? Well, no good. You know, it doesn't really, I mean, in terms of, you know, helping students do better in schools or helping them learn better or even, you know, deciding which classes or which kind of school a person doesn't really help with any of that. What was it primarily used for? Well, it was primarily used in the early 20th century to make these racist and sexist determinations or other kinds of judgments about people that we didn't like. You know, you're a winner, you're a loser. You know, mm-hmm. you go here, you can't go there. And so it was more about control, and it kind of helped people that were wanting to control groups of people that they deemed inferior to, you know, give them a really clear and easy stamp to put on people's foreheads. And that was about it. That was the usefulness of intelligence, you know, that it didn't enable educators to do their jobs any better. And it didn't enable, say, employers to better screen individuals to determine, you know, who the best worker is that I should hire for this job. I mean, it really didn't help anyone do anything, you know, functional or useful in our society. It was just this measurement that was used for control and stamping people and giving them little, you know, badges of good or bad. And I think that, you know, in the 21st century, we're more aware that, you know, that's not a very useful or nice activity, you know, that we have better things to do. And, you know, gradually over the 20th century, a new measurement took precedent, which was human capital, mm-hmm. that schools should actually give students knowledge, give students skills, and that these were useful tools that could be used to help an individual develop themselves, develop their capabilities, and then go on to more schooling, like higher education, go into the labor market and, you know, be a productive worker. That idea that we needed to measure something, kind of the measurement transformed as people realized that intelligence and IQ, you know, wasn't really useful. Let's find a better useful measurement. And so, you know, trying to measure knowledge and skills became the purpose of schooling, you know, since the 1960s and 70s. And that's where we are today. And mm-hmm. we invented, you know, a bunch of standardized tests to try to test the knowledge, which is these abstract, you know, bits of information that students memorize, and then they circle little dots on a piece of paper. And that supposedly is what they know in their brain.
So let me just quickly reintroduce. You are listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the failures of the accountability movement in education with Dr. J.M. Beach is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So you gave us a good explanation of why tests aren't working in the way that people think that they are. What about grades? What are the issues with grading students, and what are some alternatives to grades?
It's the same issue. So grades are another way that people have tried to measure an aspect of schooling, an attribute of the student, you know, SAT scores, grades, learning. We're all trying to get at something that's going on in the brain of the student that somehow translates into success in terms of reaching certain goals, whether those be academic goals, labor market goals, personal goals. So great. So the idea is that a teacher can assess the performance of a student or assess the knowledge of a student and then express what a student can do in terms of skill or what a student knows in terms of knowledge. I can boil that down into a letter or a number. So first of all, any time that we try to translate a complex experience down to a single number or letter, right there you run into a lot of trouble because it just, you can't really do that. I mean, think about, for example, just, I mean, something like your car, and the mechanic said, okay, we just serviced your car, you get a B+ today. What does that actually mean? I mean, that's just okay. Or how does that help me drive my car better? How does that tell me what I need to do to my car or not do to my, you know, I have no idea. It's meaningless information. And really, when we're talking about schools and the A's and the B's and the 95s and the 64s, it's meaningless. It doesn't really mean anything. It doesn't help anyone, especially students, do anything, you know. It's just, again, a way to put a stamp on the forehead, you're good or bad, you know. Mm-hmm. That's not helpful. And plus, you know, okay, A, B, C, we can sense the limitations of the numbers because how does that actually translate into, you know, the score of a test? Now, when we think about 95.6% on a test or 64.7, okay, we think, well, that's probably a little bit better, right? Because that's a number that looks very precise. There's got to be some reasoning and rational explanation for why you got a 67 versus a 94. But really, in reality, there isn't, you know, that how that number was determined determines the validity of the number. And so if the measurer isn't using a good measuring stick and they're not actually measuring something accurately and then translating that measurement into the right units, it's just a meaningless process. And so, you know, you write an essay. How does the teacher assign it a 94 or 6? I mean, and how do you even get a 94.6, you know? Where's the point? I mean, what makes these numbers and calculations? And then
so what's the alternative to this? You know? Like, how do you, I mean, so if the whole thing is centered on accountability, like people want to know how well do students read and write? What's the alternative if you're not going to give them a score or a grade or a test or something to determine it?
So that's the $100 question right there, is the what's the alternative? And so for many people, their main argument is that, you know, there is no alternative, that we need to measure. We need to have some sense of, you know, what a student can do or doesn't know, and that these grades, they work well enough. And there's a certain amount of truth to that. But at the same time, we need to, number one, you know, especially educators, be very aware of the limitations of our measurements, and that we need to know that, you know, the measurements that we're producing, they're all flawed and imperfect. And then with that, you know, we need to have a conversation as educators, which the educational research community is doing, about how to make better measurements and how to train teachers to better measure learning in the classroom. And at the same time, we also need to think about, okay, how are those measurements going to get used and for what purpose? So most measurements, most of the time, they're used for political and economic purposes, to sort students, to sort teachers, to punish, you know, bad teachers that are producing bad numbers or bad students producing bad numbers, reward good students, reward good teachers. That's a political process, you know, and the rewards are often economic. So it becomes an economic process. Now that doesn't help teachers do their job or students do their job. So we need to also think about, how do we create numbers that are both valid, but that are also useful for educational ends as opposed to political or economic ends? So then we need to decouple the measurement process from the evaluation process. And we also need to rethink who should be making the measurements. So if we're using measurements to gauge, let's say, student learning, to help students learn better and more so that they will have, you know, more skill, more knowledge to live better lives. Well, who should do that? Well, people that know about learning and teaching should do that. Teachers should do that. Educational researchers should do that. Who shouldn't do that? Administrators who don't know about teaching and learning. They shouldn't be doing that, you know, and other outsiders who don't know about that phenomenon. And so teachers should be, who are in the classroom, engaging their students and figuring out, how do I make measurements? How do I create grades or marks that help me assign how much a student knows or can do in this classroom, meeting their needs, meeting my needs, knowing they're imperfect? How do I fix them? How do I use them? How do I evolve them? You know, and then having other teachers in that conversation and having teachers watch and evaluate other teachers, and not to hire and fire them or to say good or bad, but to say, this seemed to be working, or that didn't seem to be working. You know, why was that working? Why wasn't that working? And have a conversation. Well, maybe I should do more of this tomorrow and less of this tomorrow, and we'll see if that works. And so that process becomes a learning process. Failure becomes, as you know, people that understand learning, failure is central to learning. It's one of the most important components of learning, that teachers and students need the space to fail. And they need to understand failure and how to deal with failure and how to recognize and use failure in order to improve in performance, rather than to see failure as this permanent blot on your personality that enables people to label you as inferior or bad. You know, that doesn't help anyone. Mm-hmm. And so that's where we need to start, is to reimagine measurements as instruments for learning rather than instruments for sorting.
So I'm curious as to whether you can identify any place or particular school or even a country or area where they're doing this well. I mean, people talk about Finland all the time. Is that the model we should be going for, or is there some other place?
Yeah, I mean, there are, I think Finland is one example. Linda Darling Hammond wrote a wonderful book called The Flat World in Education. And she kind of looks at some different countries. Although she identifies South Korea, which I talk about in one of my books, and I think she gets it very wrong in terms of what they're actually doing over there. They produce great results, but how they do it is essentially torture. It's a very rough process on kids. Same thing in China, it produces great results. Malaysia as well, very tough on students, too tough. So I think that there are many examples in other countries where you have schools that work better, they're more efficient, more economical, producing better results, but they're really rough on kids. You know, it's a really, really hard, structured, painful life for children. And then you have other schools, you know, in Scandinavian countries that seem to have a better understanding of how to treat and pay teachers as trained professionals, give them the space to do their jobs and to come up with their own measurements and not having administrators or politicians tell them what to do all the time and try to control them. And I think they do a lot of things very well, but they also have much more homogeneous cultures than most other places, certainly in the United States. And that is part of the reason why they're able to do things well over there. But in terms of their approach to teaching and learning, I think there is a lot to learn from those Scandinavian countries. And I think there's a lot to learn. There's a lot of private schools. There's a lot of public schools in this country. They tend to be, you know, serving the most privileged students. But there are some wonderful schools in America that just work fantastic that follow those same basic prescriptions. And again, Linda Darling Hammond, there's many educational scholars that have, you know, documented, talk about, you know, what we should be doing with teachers and students in the classroom. we know what works, but it's about translating that into actual policy and remaking institutions and just enabling teachers and students to do the work. And so it becomes, you know, an economic issue, a political issue, you know, that we need to have the will and the money to be able to, the resources to put it into practice and to, you know, engage that practice and allow it the time to run its course. And that just takes a lot of money and a lot of, you know, freedom, creativity, and you know, there's a lot of room for failure and missteps. And administrators, politicians, local community have to be open and willing to deal with those missteps as, you know, teachers figure out what the best way to manage their classrooms are.
Okay, so once again, you're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the failures of the accountability movement in education with Dr. J.M. Beach is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again there, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in the discussion. One of the things that I think is probably necessary in order to make the kinds of changes that you're suggesting is to have something really change in the larger environment. It's very hard to get teachers to give up grades when that's how they were raised and that's how their programs are run. But we had a big change in the last 18 months. So the pandemic forced everybody to try new things. It forced parents to get more involved in things that they used to be able to just drop the kids off at the schoolhouse door and let it go from there. So what have you seen? Has it opened up any opportunities to rethink school in positive ways? What have you seen as a result of the pandemic so far?
Well, I don't think we can say we've seen anything good. You know, all of the data that we have seen thus far is really, really bad, especially for the most underserved, underprivileged students in the most impoverished areas, that things are really, really bad. But the silver lining is that during the last 2 years, many school systems have put the pause button on many dysfunctional policies, including accountability, grades, measurements, standardized tests. You know, all of that has been paused as students and teachers have just tried to struggle, you know, to communicate and meet with each other online and to have some semblance of learning in school happen, and just to try to figure out how does that work, you know. And so in this almost survival mode of the last 2 years, there is this space that's opened up. And so as we start to go back to normal, I think there is room for educational professors and researchers, politicians, parents, kids, you know, teachers to have a conversation about what wasn't working before the pandemic. And before we go back to school and re-hit the button to push play again, you know, to try to come up with some new ground rules about how we can maybe do things better. And have discussions about, you know, what is the purpose of school? What are the purposes of teachers and students in the classroom? And I think another one of the silver linings over the last 2 years is just a better acknowledgement of the, number one, mental health and physical health of students. And just thinking about that as a priority, you know, that part of the function of schools is to enable kids and young adults to be healthy, and to keep themselves healthy, and to, you know, be mentally healthy. And so we have the sense that teachers need to be more aware of health and mental health and emotions and feelings of students and how that impacts what goes on in the classroom. You know, when you have fearful, scared students at home who don't have enough to eat, and their parents are sick, and they're seeing people die, and they're feeling depressed and alienated and disconnected, how do you teach? You can't. It's impossible. And a lot of teachers in urban districts dealing with the most impoverished students have known this for decades, for a very long time, that it's impossible to teach when you have these other issues that take precedence. But I think now in national conversation, we're much more aware of some of those external issues that very much, you know, need to be brought to the forefront in terms of thinking about, in order for us to have the conditions of success in the classroom, for teachers and students to come together and to learn and grow, we need to make sure that everyone's safe and feeling good and feeling healthy and mentally secure and having enough to eat, you know, and feeling stable in their social relationships with their parents at home and their environment and feeling like this all matters and that, you know, we're going to be able to do something with this in the future and having hope. So I think that there is a lot of space which we could be using as educators to reform the narrative. The question is, will we? And when we try, you know, are people going to be listening? And, you know, I'm a little bit doubtful given, you know, just the animosity and violence that we have, you know, school districts are dealing with over masks. And, you know, in Texas, we are creating lists again of the books we're going to be burning. So there's a lot of other political and social issues that are also vying for attention. And we could swing anyway, you know, in terms of where we go. And so it just matters, you know, who is going to be speaking the loudest and the longest and the most persuasively to kind of capture the national eye about how we take our schools and are we going to do it for the betterment of students or for some other purpose, political or social.
Mm-hmm. So I know you briefly mentioned earlier South Korea. So I'm pretty sure South Korea and some of the other East Asian countries are considered ideal in the way that they run education and that they're pure meritocracies. So tell us about them and whether that's true and if there's something we can learn from the experiences of a centralized school system that relies on a lot of standardized testing.
Yeah, so I mean, having taught both in China and South Korea, spent over a year in Korea, again, they produce great results. So especially South Korea has one of the most highly educated workforces in the world. And they have the highest rates of high school graduation, of going to college, of graduating from college. Their students learn a great deal. They know a great deal. They accumulate, you know, a lot of skills. But at the same time, when you think about the process that these students have to go through, and then the end, you know, after they graduate, what are these students able to do? It's a hellish scenario in many ways. There's a phrase that the South Koreans have, which loosely correlates to examination hell, that they have this pressure cooker atmosphere, because not only do students have to take high stakes tests, but those tests are tied to, in middle school, what high school they go to, and in high school, what college they can go to. And so if you don't do well on the test at any stage, then essentially your life is over. And not only do they have high rates of academic success in South Korea, but they also have some of the highest rates of child and teen and adolescent young adult suicide. Although the government has never allowed researchers to really accurately capture the number of just how many suicides, but we're talking about a lot more suicides, you know, potentially double or more than what you would see in a Western country. So there's a lot more high stakes, you know, going on with these South Korean Chinese test takers, where they feel if they do bad on a test that their life is over, that their parents, because it's a very social culture, that how well a student does is reflected on the entire family. And so there's an immense pressure that if a student fails on the test, the whole family, the whole extended family feels that shame. And all that pressure is put on the student, the disappointment, and it just becomes psychologically unbearable for a lot of students to deal with that. So it's a process where students, especially in South Korea, but China as well, where from the age of 4 or 5 years old, they're sent to private education. And both South Korea and China more recently, have created laws to try to limit the amount of extracurricular activities that children can do and when they can do it. But in South Korea, before the most recent law change that happened about a decade ago, literally students were going to school and extracurricular activities from the time they woke up, you know, 6 or 7 in the morning, all the way, especially for high school students, all the way till 12, 1, 2 p.m. at night. And so they would spend, you know, 12, 14 hours a day doing school. And they would be, you know, going to school for X amount of time during the regular school day, but they would have classes before school. And after school, they would have a regimen of many different after school activities where they would go learning English, you know, so in order to take exams and go to a foreign language school, learning, you know, piano, music, you know, test taking skills, reading skill, you know, all sorts of skills to try to enhance their ability. So especially in South Korea, most of the schooling that kids have to do, it's all paid for by parents. And so in terms of what the state pays for, I mean, it's one of the most expensive systems in the world because parents have to pay for most of it. And the best high schools, they're not free, and certainly not college. And there isn't the same kind of financial aid that you have, say, in the United States. And so, yes, great results, but it's a, you know, very expensive process for the parents and just an unbearable process. I had, when I was in Korea, an 8-year-old tell me, I asked them, you know, how does this going to school and, you know, doing all this learning, how does this make you feel? And I had an 8-year-old tell me it felt like dying inside. Oh, and it's just, you know, broke my heart. And I wrote a little book about that experience with that title, Children Dying Inside. But that's the experience for a lot of students. Okay, so they go to these, you know, great high schools, great middle schools, great colleges. They earn their degree in higher numbers than just about every other country. Then what? There are no jobs. You know, there are very few jobs, and they don't pay very well. And especially for women, you know, the pay and job placement rate is really, really bad. And then there's all, you know, is a very sexist patriarchal culture. And so, you know, once they leave school, they either work for the government or they work for a giant corporation. There isn't much in between. Or they go back home and they work for their parents because, you know, most people, their parents run these small little shops where they don't make a lot of money. But that is the life of, you know, most students in South Korea. They have to end up, you know, going back to work for a family firm. And so there isn't much opportunity to get a good paying job to use that education unless they can somehow escape South Korea and go abroad and work for a multinational corporation, which more do it. Same thing in China. You know, more and more students are using their education to go abroad and compete with American and Western, you know, European students.
So part of what you're saying is that it's a system that prepares people for a life that doesn't even exist.
Right.
so they're learning, like sort of ruining their childhood.
Where's my prize?
So that doesn't even happen. Wow. Right. Okay. So we're actually almost out of time. So we have about a minute. I wonder if you can give us some parting words for people who are concerned about schools today and places they can look if they want to learn more about school accountability. I know I'm going to list your books, but is there a publication, website with data, someplace that people can look if they want to explore some of these issues?
As far as data goes, I would just say, you know, looking at the references, you know, in the back of both of my books, they could go to my website, jmbeach.com, and I have some of my published work. They could look in the references there. I have some references at the website of my nonprofit, 21st Century Literacy, which is www.21centurylit.org. And there's lots of resources and references on that website. There isn't one place. And so that's one of the reasons I wrote these books, because I wanted to try to assemble data from all over the disciplines in terms of research and try to bring it together under one cover. And you got two covers here. But I think that that's the best place to go, looking at the references, looking at what I've read and looked at. And then from there to kind of follow those references to find more information and data.
Okay. Well, we really appreciate all the time. I know we've had a visit from both of my cats during this time. So for our listeners, you've been listening to WGTD HDFM. This discussion of the failures of the accountability movement in education with Dr. J.M. Beach is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You're invited to listen again there, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. And I will list both of the books and all of your website information on both the Facebook page and on the show notes for this particular program. So if listeners want to pursue some of the things we've talked about, they can. Okay, so great. Thank you very much for all of your time today.
Thank you, Karen.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archive programs are available on our website, wgtd.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. Support comes from Gateway Technical College, where student success is priority. With more than 70 career programs, students graduate prepared for the career of their dreams with expert instructors, hands-on training, and dedicated support services. Learn more at gtc.edu.
This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. You're listening to Community Matters, a program that explores and highlights various local issues and organizations. It's co-hosted by Len Iaquinta, a nonprofit manager, fundraiser, and consultant, Laura Sumner Kuhn, a former journalist with the Racine Journal-Times, who currently serves as an adjunct instructor at UW Parkside, and Jane Herring,